Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, January 7th, 2019. A Sudanese protester says Sudanese police used force in Khartoum demonstrations over the weekend.
They opened the door for us to enter. The police like hunting us. We run from them into all the houses. And they're stealing, they use gases, even inside houses.
And frustrated South Sudanese petitioned the government to fix poor mobile phone networks.
The mobile networks do not respond immediately. You can dial a number for maybe sometimes 5 to 10 times before you get connected. And once you get connected, at times you do not finish the communication and the line breaks.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. More anti-government protests were held over the weekend in Khartoum and other cities across the country. Sudanese protesters and mining engineer Nour El-Din, whose full name we are not using for fear of recrimination from the government, says authorities used violence on the streets of Khartoum during weekend protests in the Sudanese capital. The phone line was cut off several times during our interview, but he managed to say that some police even entered people's homes with guns drawn.
SPA, Sudanese Professional Association, called for demonstration in Dodi and in other three places. I was one of the participants of the demonstration. There was a lot of people in separate places in the neighborhood in Dodi. The regime, the government, used very extreme violence.
When you say they used violence, you said something about how there was violence. What kind of violence? Were the police using tear gas?
Yeah, they were using tear gas even inside houses. We were in Buri, and all the neighborhood, all the people living there, they opened the door for us to enter. The police like hunting us. We run from them into all the houses, and they're stealing gases, even inside houses.
You're saying that police stepped inside houses, inside people's personal space, not out on the streets, with guns drawn, and did they shoot?
They shoot the gas. I heard fire, but I didn't see some injuries. I didn't see one. I heard that one child was shot in his leg, but I didn't see that. I heard from the people in the neighborhood that one child in one mosque shot by an armed policeman in his leg. They used about 4 hours, more than 4 hours.
That is Sudanese protester Nour El-Din speaking to me this past hour about the protests over this past weekend from Khartoum. More than 800 protesters were arrested from the hundreds of anti-government demonstrations that have been held across Sudan over the past month, and that's according to Sudan's interior minister. Ahmed Bilal told parliament that the total number of protesters arrested is 816. The number was first given by officials for those detained since the protests erupted on December 19th after the government raised bread prices. Authorities say at least 19 people have been killed in clashes during the protests, but Amnesty International puts the death toll above 35. Osman told lawmakers that 381 protests have been reported so far. Demonstrators are demanding that Sudan President Omar al-Bashir step down. He has been in office for 29 years. A retired South Sudanese senior UN civil servant who served at various UN peacekeeping missions across Africa says addressing the root causes of any conflict can bring peace and stability. Professor Peter Tingwa tells my colleague John Tanza that in the case of South Sudan, the UN mission in South Sudan should address the root causes of the conflict, which erupted in late 2013, so that peace can finally return to South Sudan.
The four peacekeeping missions I've been in have all been interested conflicts. The UN has come to provide assistance in the various aspects, the military, the political. And as you know, when conflicts come, it is usually because of the breakdown of the political dialogue. The political dialogue between the people break down, and then they resort to fighting, and then there is a humanitarian disaster. So the UN is engaged in this, first of all, to restore the dialogue politically, and then the humanitarian. And now you also have the added human rights. So that's what I've been engaged in Somalia, twice in Liberia, and in Sierra Leone. And my experience has been 3 successful, 2 not very successful.
Let's talk about these 3 successful ones and then link it up to South Sudan.
The 3 successful, one is the one of Liberia and the other one of Sierra Leone. Those are have been, but the others have not been very successful, like Somalia. Those have been successful as I've addressed there because they have examined the root causes of the conflict right from the beginning up to the end, and they are all addressed. And then they have worked programs of how to bring the country back to normality. So that's why they've been successful. For example, the one of the recent one of Liberia, the last one I left, and then the previous one of Sierra Leone, they've been very successful because the UN and the regional organization, ECOWAS, worked at it diligently. Diligently, and they worked together. They worked together in order to bring the conflict to an end. Not the one we have here, I really don't know how close the UN mission is working with, for example, the IGAD in resolving it. But when we were in West Africa, and there was a summit conference of heads of state on one of the conflicts in Sierra Leone or Liberia, the first persons to address the summit is the UN, because we are there to monitor, see what went wrong, who was wrong in fulfilling the agreement, and then the ECOWAS, they take the decision. The UN will not take the decision.
You've talked about your experience in Sierra Leone and Liberia, which was what you call successful missions in those regions. Mm. Looking at South Sudan, you wrote an article recently talking about the issues that led to the failure of the 2015 peace agreement. What are these issues?
Several of them. Several reasons. The lack of democracy, for example, is one. One of lack. When there is lack of democratic space, then people will obviously fight. And that's no different from what happened in Liberia and in Sierra Leone. Then there are the other factors, ethnic. Ethnic factors are also part of what should be addressed and causes of problem. You play it down, you ignore it, you will not arrive at a solution. You must have to look at it as peacemakers. For example, when the UN went to Somalia, nobody knew that the clan is a very critical issue in the life of the Somalis. Everybody said, oh, they are all Somalis, they speak the same language and that's it. When we went there, it was not true. They speak the same language, they are the same religion, but you have to know that clan component, the Darod and the Hawiye and the Sak, you have to know them and see how they interact. So without taking those things into account, and you treat that, oh, these are all South Sudanese, they are the same, you will have ignored a very critical factor.
That is Professor Peter Tingwa, a retired South Sudanese UN civil servant. He was speaking to my colleague John Tanza. A group of civil society activists representing more than 100 groups in South Sudan say citizens are outraged about the country's poor phone networks and are calling on the government to do something about it. South Sudanese say they often cannot get in touch with loved ones or handle business affairs with their associates because the networks are down. Demo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
In March 2018, South Sudan's government shut down Vivacell, a major mobile phone operator in the country, over tax-related claims, putting a strain on the remaining two mobile phone networks operating in the country, Zain and MTN. Juba resident Clement Lado Gore says since the government shut down Vivacell, the remaining two mobile phone networks have deteriorated.
Really, I'm not feeling well these days because network is not as well as possible, good as before. As we, if you want to call someone maybe at around 9 or something like that, it always stay, network fail, user busy. As, it's not good as the one for Vivacell as before. Vivacell, you can call direct and you find the line is open. Even at times, maybe the phone of the owner is on, then it will say that the user is not around or the user is busy.
Speaking in Arabic, Juba resident Peter Johnson says he only makes calls during evening hours because of poor mobile phone network connections during daytime hours.
Since Vivacell
closed, until now I have not got any better network to link up with the people, either within or outside South Sudan. It is only from 10 p.m. that the MTN network becomes clear. And sometimes you can call someone and you receive an automated message saying the number you are calling is not reachable, and yet it is on.
Rajab Mohandis, executive director for local advocacy group Organization for Responsive Governance, led a group of civil society activists today to present a petition to South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwe, asking him to address the inefficient mobile telecommunication networks in the country. Mohandi says customers are being exploited by mobile phone operators in South Sudan.
In most cases, the mobile telephone network services that they provide for internet is extremely weak. You pay for these services, you do not use them, and the money just goes. And so we are very much concerned about this. It affects people in terms of businesses. It affects people in terms of calling for emergencies, health emergencies, security emergencies. People rely on these telephones, even for economic reasons, like trying to help members of families in different locations.
Rajab says he understands the strain on the few remaining mobile phone operators serving the entire country, but says the companies must ensure the quality of services will improve for frustrated subscribers.
The mobile networks do not respond immediately. You can dial a number for maybe sometimes 5 to 10 times before you get connected. And once you get connected, at times you do not finish the communication and the line breaks. In most cases, you call numbers that are active and you get an automated response saying this number does not exist. Surprisingly, it's a number that is registered and it's active that it doesn't exist. At times it says it's off when the number is on.
Wani Michael from OK Africa Foundation says the government must intervene to ensure that citizens receive better services from their mobile phone operators. And he says the network's usage rate per minute has become extremely high. Michael is also calling on Information and Telecommunications Minister Michael Makwe to fix the problem.
This is the body in which there is a Department of Customer Care. Because you are all customers. There is a Department of Customer Care. And any customer who has any complaint, complains to that directorate in the national communication. And once you present your complaint, they will study it. And if they cannot, or if they are not in a position to resolve it, they will forward it to the head of the NCA. If the head of the NCA is unable to address it, he may table it before the board of directors. And if they are capable of doing it, then like your issues, where you are complaining about poor services, you will call the service provider and tell them here is a complaint. What are you doing about it?
Makwe acknowledged he received the petition, but insists the activists failed to follow the necessary bureaucratic steps required to present their petition. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The wife of a South Sudanese activist arrested in Nairobi over a year ago says the first vice president is ignoring her pleas to free her husband. Find out who when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
who comes first in your life?
My sister comes first, because she was the one who raised me. She taught me how to do everything, so she'll come first.
Definitely God, but I think when talking about people, I think my family and my friends, just people who I've, you know, surrounded myself with.
I think the woman that I love. Every moment I think about her, every moment I wish I'm around her, because she makes me happy. She gives me a lot of peace. She has a way of helping me to just relax and calm down.
My mom comes first in my life because she has really done a whole lot for me, and if there's anything, I would really want to do something to honor her.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The wife of a South Sudanese activist who disappeared in Nairobi in 2017 accuses South Sudan's first vice president, Taban Deng Gai, of ignoring her calls to free her husband. Aya Warali, the wife of activist Agri Idri, says she has made several attempts to speak with Gai, but says the first vice president, who is a friend of her husband's, has been avoiding her. Warali tells John Tanza that Gai's silence speaks volumes.
I know him personally. I know that they were friends. So that was the first person I tried to contact. I know his number. I tried calling his number. I tried through his office manager, but I couldn't get him. The office manager kept on telling me he would call me back because he had already given the vice president my number, but he never called me back. I tried through his family. His wife was a good friend of mine. We stayed in the same place. I used to go to their house. But again, no call. To me, being somebody very close to these guys, he would be the right person to tell me what was happening. And being somebody also I know, at least he would sympathize with me and tell me what he knew that time. Even now, he would have told me what he knows about this guy. But he's not talking to me. I feel bad because I wouldn't want my husband to do that to any of his colleagues' wife.
You are telling me that you have made several attempts to speak to the first vice president, Taban Deng Gai. Even you try to reach out to the wife and you're not getting the right response. What options are you left with?
You know, I still need to talk to him because as somebody who is inside, because I wasn't going to him because he was a vice president, but a friend of theirs, a friend of ours, somebody we know, at least would sympathize with us and stand with us. But avoiding me made me feel really bad.
And you have gone to court several times. You know, the Kenyan government was petitioned and they said they are not responsible. In this kind of a situation, how would you want to move forward?
If somebody had gone through what we've gone through as a family, they would understand what we are talking about. For me and my family, all what we want now is the release of these people. Courts, all these things will not yield anything for now. If they are kept wherever they are being kept, it's not good for their health. My husband is a sick person. I don't know whether they are taking care of that. My request now is, I've put everything aside. I don't want to go to court with anybody. I just want my husband out. That should be very clear to all the people involved.
And who are the people you're pointing fingers at this time?
John, I don't know. If Juba is telling us to ask Kenya, and we know very well these people actually reach Juba, now, who do we blame? Or who do we ask? I'm just saying anybody who is involved in this, I'm assuring you, I have no case against you. Just release my husband.
President Kiir is in charge of the country. If you are given an opportunity to speak to President Kiir, what would you tell him?
I've heard severally that he said he didn't know anything about these people. Being the president, he will still be responsible for whatever somebody has done under his leadership. My message to him is, release these guys. Now we are in the process of implementing this peace. Even the leaders of IO are already in Juba. Why are you still holding my husband? What crime has he committed? Why don't you look at it from the angle of family? We are family. Yeah, we don't want anything from anybody. We just want our loved ones to come back to the family. So why are you still holding him? Believe me, I don't understand. I failed to understand why they're still keeping these people. I don't even know where. We don't know their health condition. Why are people torturing? Why do you want your future friend dead? I don't understand. My request is, let them release our loved ones. That's my message to the president and to all the people who are working with him, including Vice President Tabandengai.
That's Aya Wareley, wife of detained South Sudanese activist Agri Idri. She was speaking to John Tanza from Nairobi. Meanwhile, the family of Samuel Dong, who disappeared from Nairobi at the hands of unknown security agents, say life is difficult without their father. Paulette Gok War, a relative of Dong's who has stepped in to look after his children, says Dong's wife has a medical condition which further complicates life for the activist's children.
It is tough. It is tough. Dong was the breadwinner, not only for the children, but to an extension to us, the relatives. So you can imagine, if the children are, their mother is mentally ill for 5 to 6 years, she has no attention of her children, their father is not around. So it is that toughness that any human being can understand.
This sounds a little bit heartbreaking. Now, with all this happening, you're not getting an answer from the Kenyan government. You're not getting an answer from the South Sudan government. What is the family going to do?
Well, we have hopes. We have done what we could have done. We went to court, which is what we ought to do. Through Amnesty International, they assisted us and in that position. But we will keep on asking. You know, there will come a time when we will sit down as South Sudanese and we will question ourselves what will happen. And someone will be responsible.
No, but you just said here that you and the family are pointing their fingers at the office of the first vice president. Have you made any attempts to speak to him? You yourself, I mean, you know, you've been running up and down. Have you spoken to the first vice president, Tabandengai?
I've tried to reach out to him. I failed.
Why did you fail?
He's not accessible. You see, there's that paranoia. For him, he's already a victim of public outcry. He does not want to speak to people that are asking about Dong and Agri. He doesn't want to. Even his office agents, I tried reaching out to Mr. Agel Mashar. I went straight asking for what happened to these people. Where are they? He has no answer. Then I continued.
What did he tell you?
Well, I approached him. I asked him, people are pointing fingers at the office you are working in, headed by the first vice president, Mr. Taban. The public is saying, even now we are convinced, as family, that Taban is wholly responsible for this. But he said, no, Taban is not responsible. Then I continued. A lie must be limited to a certain number of people, but almost those who are informed, well informed about this case, they are pointing fingers at Taban. You should ask yourself, why me?
Someone would ask you, do you have any proofs to show? I mean, you're a law student. You have to have some evidence, credible evidence. Do you have that to accuse Taban of being behind the disappearance of Samuel Dong and Agri Idri?
Yes, I can prove that. And any, in this case, it is a question of facts. Whether you are a law student or not, you can prove it. Around September 2016, when Mr. Taban was in New York to represent the president during the UN General Assembly, Taban spoke to Dong in my presence.
Where was this? Where did they meet?
On phone. Taban was in US, Dong was here in Kenya. He was telling Dong to stop what he was doing.
What was Samuel Dong doing?
Dong, just like any civil rights activist, is a critic of bad governance of South Sudan. Actually, he went ahead condemning Taban for the unprocedural taking over power from Mr. Machar. That's the genesis of the fallout between Dong and Mr. Taban. That's the center, if I'm to put it in a nutshell.
You are speaking here on behalf of Samuel Dong's family. If you're given an opportunity to speak to Taban, Dengai, and President Salva Kiir, what would you tell them?
What I would tell the two leaders, first to the president, General Salva Kiir. He is the president of a sovereign state. If his junior officers are doing what is unlawful, illegal in his presence, is equally negligent to the act.
What do you mean? You're speaking law, and I'm not a law expert. I don't understand negligent to the act.
What I'm saying is, if Taban is responsible for the disappearance, as Honorable Makwe put it, that the IO leadership under Taban is responsible, and Taban is the first vice president, the president should not keep quiet and let people do parallel things without his consent and his knowledge.
That's Pulit Gagwar, a relative of activist Samuel Dong, who disappeared from Nairobi, speaking to John Tanza from Nairobi. Magwi County residents of Torrid state they lack a hospital, and that's putting the lives of patients at risk. Patients often must travel far to reach the nearest major hospital, Juba Teaching Hospital. It's located 153 kilometers away. Winnie Serino has the story for VOA from Juba.
Achan Lili, a mother of eight, says she witnessed several mothers and babies die in the primary health care center while giving birth due to a lack of proper health facilities, especially in the maternity ward. Speaking in her native Acholi language, Lily says the referral hospitals are too far to travel when someone's life is in danger.
You find that out when a woman gives birth, because birth is between death and life. At times you will get that blood is little, or the baby takes too long to come out, so that needs to be referred somewhere. Going up to Nyimele, with our bad roads and long distance, definitely someone would die. Last year, we saw that if a child did not die, the mother would instead die.
Helen Andiko, a nurse at Margaret Primary Health Care Center, says the health facility has only one ambulance, which is shared between Margaret and Ayachi counties. She says the ambulance helps but often breaks down and is missing several features of a typical ambulance. Speaking in her native Acholi language, Andiko says most families bear the responsibility of transporting patients to referral hospitals. She says it's not uncommon for very sick patients or pregnant mothers to die on the way.
If there's an emergency case that we can't handle as a health center, we need to send the person to a hospital. In most cases, we take them to Nimele or Juba Teaching Hospital. Those in Akasi are taken to Kitgum in Uganda because it's nearer to them. The other issue is an ambulance that has lasted for years, it doesn't have all the necessary equipment inside. When we need it for emergency, you will find that it is spoiled.
Magwi County resident Oloya James says the primary health care centers in the county lack basic equipment like X-ray machines. Oloya says many people whose family members are referred to hospitals in Nimule or Juba cannot afford the transport fare or the hospital fees if they do get there.
Transport is the problem. From here to Juba is 2,500. From here to Nimule is 3,000. From here to Torit is 2,000. Each person. Now, if they say to you that you buy fuel, now one jerrycan here is 5,200. That one is very expensive.
Focus tried without success to reach Torit State Health officials for comment on this story. Torit State Health Minister Pascal Ifita was not reachable by phone and was said to have traveled to a remote part, the state, without mobile phone network. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
That's our show for this Monday. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Tune in tomorrow.